I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment today, did you know a quarter of all American homeowners now own homes worth less than the mortgage on them? Now, more and more are turning to short selling. We're going to find out what that is today. And as always, with our financial explainers, no question too silly. But we want to start with a story that is front page news here in New England and is provoking the question, should kids be allowed to fire Uzis for fun? Police here in Massachusetts are investigating whether any charges should be filed in the case of 8-year-old Christopher Bazile, the Connecticut boy who accidentally killed himself while firing an Uzi at a machine gun shoot at the Westfield Sportsman's Club. Both an instructor and the boy's father were watching the child when the recoil from the weapon forced it upward and sent the bullet into the boy's jaw. His father said when other kids were firing on the same day, instructors held the gun to prevent kickback, and they didn't with Christopher. As tragic as his death is, it's also got people wondering, how common are festive machine gun shoots with kids firing on pumpkins and old vehicles, and are they legal? A Massachusetts state rep said he plans to draft a bill to ban anyone under 21 from firing an automatic weapon. He said it's almost indescribable that within a year of leaving a booster seat, an 8-year-old can hold a submachine gun. But what is the current law? Kenneth Jost is a lawyer and associate editor for the publication CQ Researcher. So, Ken, what do Massachusetts laws say about this?
The law appears to be ambiguous. There is a provision in Massachusetts law that allows a parent to allow a child under the age of 15 to use a rifle or shotgun at this kind of shooting event, but machine guns aren't included there. There's another provision that authorizes state authorities to issue a license for a club that provides this kind of show. And the question is the relationship between those two provisions, and that's a question for lawyers and for the state legislature.
But meanwhile, people are finding out that there are many of these machine gun shoots. We spoke to Glenn Morris. He owns Machine Gun Safari. Now, that's a completely different company from the Massachusetts one where this terrible accident took place. Machine Gun Safari is in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. For the past 4 years, they've also had machine gun shoots. People can fire automatic weapons for a $200 fee. He says that he feels mistakes were made in the Massachusetts club, that, for instance, he has young people use larger Uzis than this 8-year-old used, because the larger Uzi can have more control for an instructor. There's more for an instructor to grab. Others have said that the smaller Uzi would be more likely to flip. You know, is there any distinction anywhere in law about, you know, the size of a gun?
In Massachusetts, the two provisions that I mentioned appear to distinguish between rifle and shotgun and machine guns. In New York, if I read the law there correctly, this would definitely be illegal. A child under the age of 12 can only fire an air gun, not a real gun, at one of these shoots. So, yes, the law does distinguish between these weapons. Machine guns in general are very heavily regulated, virtually banned, according to the gun safety group, the Brady Center. The Massachusetts law prohibits possession of a machine gun except on the premises of one of these shooting ranges.
So that's, because that's another question people have. You know, we thought machine guns were banned. Is it because these are supposed to be licensed shooting areas that they're legal?
Machine guns that were owned and registered with the federal government prior to 1986 were grandfathered under a 1986 law. The Brady Center spokesman that I spoke to says if this weapon wasn't registered before 1986, he thinks it's illegal.
Well, as we said, police are investigating the legality of this. Meantime, we were surprised at how many machine gun shoots there are across the country. A search on YouTube, very quick search, you can find several events with young kids firing automatic weapons. And one, you see a boy firing an automatic weapon. He nearly loses control of it. We have links to some of these videos at our website, here-now.org. Do we have any understanding of why they are so popular recently?
Well, I was interested in finding online an advertisement for the Knob Creek Gun Range show in Kentucky, which advertises itself as the largest machine gun shoot in the country. And the promo describes the thrill that the shooter will get from firing at barrels of fuel with pyrotechnic charges attached that then go off and create large and small mushroom clouds and fireballs from hell. So I guess for a shooting enthusiast, that's a kick.
Well, is there any connection between the popularity of these machine gun ranges and the expiration of the assault weapons ban in 2004?
Machine guns are actually more heavily regulated than semi-automatic weapons, which were for a time banned but now have been legal since 2004. But in general, if you read gun show literature and look at the website of the National Rifle Association, you'll see that gun owners promote enthusiasm among shooters. This is part of a culture that's ingrained in them and that they thoroughly approve of and want to pass on to their sons and daughters.
And they're feeling a little bit embattled today. Again, Glenn Morris, who owns the Machine Gun Safari up in New Hampshire, says that he thinks that this is very safe, that obviously we have this horrible incident, but that's rare. More people die in car accidents. I mean, is this going to be just a regurgitation of the old debate about guns, or is there going to be something more here because these were Uzis?
It's interesting that I called the National Rifle Association this morning and didn't get any immediate comment. I think it's correct that gun rights advocates will be a little embarrassed by this. At the same time, accidental shooting deaths of minors are rare. There have been three in Massachusetts from over a five-year period, according to the federal agency that collects these statistics.
Well, speaking of the response of the gun community, Bob Greenleaf, a gun enthusiast and a former executive board member of the club in Massachusetts where 8-year-old Christopher died, says that allowing the child to shoot the Uzi alone, without someone holding the gun with him, was not only stupid but negligent. And so perhaps, you know, there may be some change from within the gun community.
That's certainly possible. The comments on a couple of the newspapers that provided sites for commenting, many expressed horror at the notion of an 8-year-old firing a machine gun.
Kenneth Jost is a lawyer and associate editor for CQ Researcher. Kenneth, thanks for speaking with us.
Glad to be with you.
To the housing crisis. According to a closely watched index out today, home prices fell by the sharpest annual rate ever in August. The 20-city Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index shows that home prices tumbled 16.6% from August 2007 to August 2008. That's good news for anyone wanting to buy a home, but terrible news for anyone who wants to sell. By the end of the year, a third of all homes on the market will be foreclosures. Some states, such as Massachusetts, North Carolina, California, have passed laws to delay the foreclosure process. Nearly a quarter of Americans with mortgages now owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. And they may turn to something called short selling, but it comes at a price. John Anderson is a realtor with Twin Oaks Realty in Minnesota's Twin Cities. John, let's start with, what is a short sale, simply put?
Well, Robin, a short sale is where a homeowner actually owes more than the value that they can realize in a sale in today's market. The bank is going to be short if we sell this property.
Well, and we'll get to that in a second, but there's other ways that we have this discrepancy between a mortgage and a home's worth. A lot of people use their house as a piggy bank. They were taking money out, borrowing money, adding to the mortgage, and then, oops, the house value plummeted.
Well, I think you hit it right on, because I've been selling for 28 years, and we had a down market in the early 80s, but we did not have home equity loans, second mortgages, those type of products available and used as often. So even though the market went down, we didn't have the same type of problem. That's what has really made this a more difficult situation today, is that people have used up their equity, not just in the purchase, but in taking out the money to do other things.
Right. So whether it's because they have these adjustable interest rates that have shot up, or they have been borrowing against their house, they suddenly have the situation where they're holding a mortgage for, you know, $800,000, let's say, but the house has plummeted to four. Now, you said the bank is going to be short. It feels like the homeowner's a little short here. Take us through the process. First of all, how does someone know to even speak to you? What prompts them to come in and talk to you?
Some cases, they've been transferred across the country. In some cases, their mortgage payment has gone up more than what they can handle. Maybe life has happened to them.
Right.
There's a loss of a job. And so for those reasons, they come to us and say, I think I need to sell my house.
Right. And they recognize, oh, my gosh, the value is so low and the mortgage is so high. What do you say to them?
Well, the first thing we try to do is, if it's all possible, try to keep them in the house. There is a lot of negotiating going on between sellers, homeowners, and banks today, where the banks are actually willing to in some cases, drop the principal balance, adjust payments, adjust interest rates, because needless to say, the banks don't want all these homes back either. So that's the first thing that I try to do, is see if we can make contact with the bank in order to try to negotiate. But in some cases, they just can't afford to stay in that house, or they're moving out of state, in which case then we have to sit down and look at a plan. What is this house going to sell for in this market, and try to determine what that shortage is going to be?
And that brings us to a potential short sale. How would that work?
In the short sale situation, there's really two ways. A pre-negotiated one, where we will go to the bank even before we put it on the market or at the beginning of a marketing plan. In that situation, quite often the banks will come to us and say, show us the financial statements, show us your tax returns, show us a broker's price opinion of what the value of that property, what you think it's going to sell for. Let us have a conversation as to whether we'll take something off or not and negotiate something off.
Right.
The second way is that we contact the bank, we let them know this is happening, and then they'll say, all right, here's the package I want. Once you get a purchase agreement, get me the purchase agreement, get me the financial statements, a letter of explanation, and then we'll get back to you in some time as to whether we will accept the short sale and what amount.
Right. And, you know, you say the banks come up short. They do, because they're now agreeing with you and the homeowner that they'll agree to a sale, even though they're not going to get, let's say, stay with that $800,000. They're going to get $400,000. But this is better to the banks than foreclosure, when they just get a house that's going to sit empty.
No, that's exactly right, because in foreclosure, in a lot of cases around the country, let's use my state for example, it may take 4 to 5 months to get the foreclosure started, and then there's 3 to 4 months of them hiring an attorney, starting the legal process of that, and then there's a 6-month redemption period in Minnesota, at least, that the seller still has the right to redeem it. So it could be, in that case, maybe up to a year or longer before that they even have the chance to resell the property. And then at that point, it's taking the gamble that they can even still sell it for $400,000 at that time.
Right. And I picked those numbers out of the air, but they're awfully high for some parts of the country. But so what is happening? Are banks agreeing, okay, go ahead, sell the house for $400,000, we'll get at least our $400,000, and we'll forgive the other $400,000 that, you know, was the extra on the mortgage?
The answer to that is yes, they are. Just in the last month in the Twin Cities area, 47% of the sales last month were either foreclosures or short sales of the total sales in the Twin Cities area.
Yeah.
I'm sure those numbers are similar in lots of areas around the country. So banks have come to realize, you know what, if we can stop this now, if we can get the most money possible now, it's better for us. And they're going to want to have their own price opinions to see if what you're selling it for is justifiable.
Well, and if they agree, what happens to the seller? Does it go somewhere on their record that they, does this come up as a default on that part of the mortgage that they didn't cover with the sale?
It is something that the seller must consider, is that a short sale is going to show up on the credit report in somewhat a similar way to that of a foreclosure. I think that why some people like this concept is that, first of all, they didn't go through that whole foreclosure process. They'd made an attempt in order to pay off their mortgages.
John Anderson, a realtor with Twin Oaks Realty in Minneapolis-St. Paul, has been explaining that often banks will forgive the difference because they'd rather get some money, even if it doesn't cover the mortgage they expected back. Now, the downside for the seller, a short sale does show up on your credit report. It's called voluntary repossession. But as John just said, it's better than a foreclosure when homeowners default on the entire mortgage. And John, we understand there's another category of short seller. To continue with the example we've been using, these would be people with, say, an $800,000 mortgage, who can only sell for $400,000. They sell for that, but then they still have a mortgage of $400,000 to make up that difference. These are people who are short selling. They no longer own a home, but they choose to still have a mortgage on that home they don't own?
Well, and I think what they're trying to do in that case is totally protect their credit. We're working with a case like that right now where the bank is willing to transfer the difference into a personal loan. It's not going to be secured. They'll continue to make payments, pay that off, and it won't show up as if they've had any lates then, which will more quickly help them purchase a home down the road.
Oh, but that's got to be tough to have a mortgage on a house you don't even own anymore.
Well, it is difficult to do that, but it is just as difficult or sometimes more to have totally lost it, which Maybe that means there's 7 years until you can purchase a home again or whatever the bank is going to allow.
Right, until your credit is good enough.
Right. So your credit's good enough. In this case, possibly you can get into a home quicker.
I said, by the way, John, that some people are choosing to do that kind of a short sale, but you point out that the banks force some people to do it. I mean, if you have the wherewithal, if you have the money, they're not going to let you walk away from a short sale without doing something about that difference.
And that's the reason why they are going to ask to see copies of W-2s, of pay stubs, of tax returns, because this is not being done for a person just that says, I want to walk away, I'd like to move to Hawaii, and I can't sell my house, so I'm just going to walk away. This is made for a situation where someone really is in trouble, can't afford to keep the house. We're willing to try to negotiate out this.
A couple quick questions, John Anderson. We hear that there are scam artists here. You got to be careful. If you know someone that says for a special fee, they'll get you a short sale, right? Watch out for that.
Well, and I actually was involved in a level of actually testifying in Washington, D.C. on this from a senior level, especially going after senior citizens. And they're having them transfer the property to a third party. Then they take whatever equity they can out of the property, and the seller or senior in those cases ends up with nothing on top of not having anything negotiated.
Right.
Or they're paying fees to someone to have this done, and they never do anything for those fees. So be very careful. Use a respectable realtor or someone that knows what they're doing and you can trust.
A licensed realtor. And by the way, we want to make sure what you're referring to is different from a reverse mortgage.
Exactly right. Yeah, no, reverse mortgage is where you actually are putting a mortgage on and then taking out money every month in order to help pay their expenses and stay in that house. Now, let's say that I got a $200,000 house. I'll go and put $160,000 loan on there, an FHA reverse mortgage, and then each month I'm going to get $1,000 a month out of there.
Because,
but you still own.
Yeah, because these older people presumably own the home free and clear to begin with.
Correct. Or may have a very small mortgage, but they can't afford the taxes. They can't afford their monthly health insurance, let's say, and they stay in the house and use the reverse mortgage to help them pay their expenses.
Right, knowing that it's going to reduce the value of the home, but they're older and presumably going to be leaving it eventually anyway.
Well, and in that situation, a lot of times it's still cheaper than going into assisted living or some other place, which may cost a lot more.
And another question we have for you, we've heard from people who've been foreclosed who ask, well, wait a second, I'm foreclosed or a short sell, and the arrangement I have with the bank is that they forgive me whatever my mortgage can't be covered by that sale. Can the bank ever go after those people down the road?
And the answer to that question is yes, the bank can possibly go after them down the road. We're not seeing it happen very often, but you do have to take that into account. They could possibly try to put a judgment, a deficient judgment against you, and so that if you do get assets down the road, that judgment would hold against you.
Yeah.
These things are not easy to do, and again, we're not seeing it. The banks are more than willing in most cases just to say, we're going to take what we can and move on.
And John, by the way, if you're the seller or if you're a buyer on the other side of a short sale, you mentioned how many months foreclosure can take for the bank, which is why the banks don't want to wait that long, so they might be encouraged to do a short sale. How much extra time does a short sale take?
Well, it can really vary a lot, but I start out by telling both buyer and seller, be very patient here. I've seen them approved in a 7-day period, but I had one just recently that took us over 13 weeks for the bank to finally approve us. So it needs to be a situation where both buyer and seller are willing to be patient and wait. And if you do the paperwork correct and it's a good transaction, it will get done, but be patient. We are seeing sales uptick a little bit, which is a good sign, but what we haven't seen is the values are still dropping, at least in the Twin Cities and other areas, not as fast. But we need stability, and that's what those of us have been around a long time. Just give me a stable bottom is what we need right now.
John, can you give me an average drop that you're seeing in homes in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area? I mean, what they were in price and what they are now in price?
Yeah, well, we're probably back to about 2003 levels, which is probably about anywhere from a 15 to 20% drop in a lot of cases. You know, we're seeing situations, a couple of them we just done recently, where 700,000 sold for 400,000, like you were saying, and even 260 now selling for 160. It's in your neighborhood. That affects the value of your neighborhood, and you have no control over that. If you wanted to sell and you're a normal seller right now, it's tough.
Right,
you know?
Because the foreclosed and short-selling homes are dropping the values.
Yeah. They're killing you. They just kill you. Literally, in some townhouse condo projects we see especially, I have one where they were all selling, and this is low, again, we're here instead of Boston, but let's say 130s, they're selling for $60,000-$70,000. Well, you're not going to get your 130 anymore if the foreclosures are selling at $60,000-$70,000.
Those poor people who thought that was going to be their investment.
Oh, long term, right. Yeah. And they did nothing wrong, right?
I mean, these aren't subprime mortgages that you know that, yeah.
Exactly. And that's why these reverse mortgages are becoming big, because people can't afford to sell. You know what I mean?
Right, so they're going to live in it.
Yep.
John Anderson is a realtor with Twin Oaks Realty in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. He's been helping us today understand short selling. John, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
There's a question on the ballot in several states next Tuesday that conservative Christians say is more important than the presidential election. In fact, some are saying the outcome could lead to Armageddon. It's gay marriage. It hasn't been mentioned much on the campaign trail, but it is appearing on ballots in Arizona, Florida, and in California, where Proposition 8 would ban same-sex marriage, reversing a decision by the state's high court earlier this year, allowing gay couples the right to marry. Religious conservative leaders say that if gay marriage in California is not stopped, the result will be Armageddon. They say that if Prop 8 fails and a minister refuses to marry a same-sex couple, that church could be sued or lose its tax-exempt status. Well, opponents of Prop 8 say that these are just untrue scare tactics. Today, we want to continue our look at ballot questions. Last week, we looked at several measures on taxes. Today, what are the other measures besides gay marriage? John Matsusaka is president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute at the University of Southern California. And John, let's look at another hot-button issue, abortion, which is on ballots in South Dakota and Colorado. This takes on greater overtones this year because of vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin, who's been vocal about her choice to give birth to a baby with Down syndrome, and her 17-year-old daughter being pregnant. So let's start with South Dakota's ballot proposal about abortion.
South Dakota has a measure which is, I suppose you might call it moderate as far as abortion types of issues go. It's a law that attempts to ban abortion, but it provides exceptions for the health of the mother, rape, incest, and so forth. The reason I'm emphasizing that it's somewhat moderate in that limited sense is that they had a similar measure on the ballot 2 years ago that was an outright ban on abortion with no exceptions at all, and that measure was rejected. So the proponents came along with a version which they view as more moderate, where they provided more exceptions for these special cases because there was exit polling suggested that that was a decisive issue for many voters.
And what's interesting there is that Sarah Palin, for instance, would only make an exception for the mother's life. And in South Dakota, the ballot question is making exceptions for the health of the mother and exceptions for rape.
That's right, and they're getting a little resistance from the very strong pro-life side on that issue because they don't like those exceptions. Mm-hmm. Their proponents are looking at this in a broader way. They basically want to have a law that bans abortion in some form to get approved because they want it to be challenged in court, and they want this to make its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court in the hope of creating a test case for Roe versus Wade.
And what about the Colorado question? Because that doesn't even mention abortion.
So Colorado has a really interesting issue, which is defining a person as a human being from the moment of fertilization. Of course, the effect of this would be to ban abortion. It could ban all kinds of other things, presumably as well, medical procedures that might be critically important. This measure, from what I've heard, is perceived to be a very extreme measure. I think its chance of a passage is remote.
I want to take a look at energy because that's such a huge issue, and states have taken up where they feel the federal government maybe has lagged behind, in particular California. And California has a Proposition 7 requiring all utilities to generate 20% of their energy from renewable fuel sources by 2010, and then that rises up 40% 2020, 50 in 2025. And we know that this is a trend, to require not just publicly owned utilities, but private companies to do this. And it's a trend that started with Colorado's Amendment 37 in 2004. So remind us, so who put this on the ballot? Who's behind this? What's your sense of this proposition?
This is part of a general trend to force utilities to start using more renewable and clean fuels. One of the interesting things about this measure, though, is that it's attracted the opposition of almost all major environmental organizations, from the Sierra Club to solar energy producers and so forth. And the reason is it's written in such a way that it only defines a clean energy provider to be a firm that uses a certain type of fuel to generate its energy, but also generates more than 30 megawatts of power. So it turns out that a vast number of solar energy producers and wind producers wouldn't qualify as clean energy because they're too small, and that would essentially destroy that industry in the state of California. So interestingly enough, it's being opposed by an overwhelming number of environmental groups. One other measure on energy that's pretty interesting is Proposition 10 in California, which is authorizing the state to borrow and spend $5 billion for alternative fuel vehicles. This is a measure that's being promoted by T. Boone Pickens, the oil man, of course, who's also interested in alternative fuels. But it's a huge amount of money. I would have expected earlier in the summer, when gas prices were so high, that the voters might be much more willing to go down this path and spend this huge amount of money for alternative fuels. It's going to be very interesting to see, now that gas prices are coming down and that we're heading in toward rockier economic times, it's going to be very interesting to see if voters are willing to go into debt to promote this now.
Right. I want to make sure we cover Washington State's ballot initiative, which is regarding assisted suicide, and it's being backed by the former governor there who has Parkinson's. Tell us about that.
It's I-1000 in the state of Washington. It's Death with Dignity is what the proponents call it, and it basically allows physicians to assist people in committing suicide, essentially, under certain set of conditions when they have a terminal disease and they're in sound state of mind.
Like Oregon's law.
That's right. And as you said, it's got a very popular former Governor Booth Gardner there up in the state who's campaigning for this. The indications are from the polls is that it's quite a popular measure.
And I want to make sure we touch on at least one of the initiatives having to do with animals, the one that assures that pregnant pigs have enough pen space. You know, this is being mocked, Florida's pregnant pigs measure, but voters seem to like this.
So Florida started this trend, which was to amend their constitution to provide a minimum amount of living space for pregnant pigs. And this was an issue that was ridiculed by many people. They said it's not the sort of thing that ought to be in a state constitution. But it was very, very popular with the voters. A similar measure passed in Arizona, again, very popular with the voters. And now they brought it to California. This is promoted by a variety of animal rights groups. One thing they've changed in California is they're, in a subtle way, expanding their agenda. They've now including not only pregnant pigs and calves, but hens, egg-laying hens. The argument that's being made against this measure is that it will make it more costly to produce eggs in the state, and instead then Californians will end up buying eggs that are produced in Mexico or some other unregulated area. So that's the economic argument that's being given against it. On the flip side, the pro forces are running some very effective ads and campaigns showing the living conditions for these animals, and I think voters are going to be very sympathetic to the notion that, can't you produce eggs at a reasonable cost under slightly better conditions.
Question 3 in Massachusetts would ban commercial dog racing in this state by 2010, and that would require the closure of two tracks. And in Alaska, ballot measure 2 would ask voters to ban aerial hunting of bears, wolves, and wolverines. This, of course, became a huge topic on the campaign trail. Sarah Palin is a backer of aerial hunting. She's a hunter herself. Hunters in Alaska say that it keeps the wolves from the moose that they like to hunt. But that's been a big topic on the campaign trail.
Animals are an issue that very frequently appears on ballot propositions. So Alaska especially, there's these battles with hunters. A couple years ago, they had a measure that banned bear baiting, which is a form of hunting. So these types of issues tend to appear in these states. I think we also have a measure in one of the states in the South, I think it might have been Oklahoma, which is declaring, completely on the other side, declaring a right to hunt. So we're seeing this as kind of low-level skirmishing between animal rights and hunting rights groups across the country.
John Matsusaka, president of the Initiative and Referendum Institute at the University of Southern California. He loves ballot questions. And John, thanks so much for putting them together for us.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
And if you also love ballot questions and want to find out more, go to our website, here-now.org. Later today, we'll have a link for you there. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. As merger talks between General Motors and Chrysler continue, the White House is now looking into options, including using part of the $700 billion bailout program fund to help the struggling automakers through a possible transition. Well, meanwhile, a transition of another sort is about to start in Moraine, Ohio. Residents of that city, just south of Dayton, thought they had 2 years until their largest employer, General Motors, might shut down the plant in Moraine. But this month, GM announced they're closing it December 23rd, and probably for good. Leonard Johnson is the mayor of Moraine. Mr. Mayor, first of all, we're so sorry about this news. You've said it's a kick in the gut, and we also understand it's a double whammy for you because you worked at that plant.
Kind of ironic. I did work there 30 years, and I was a union rep for a number of those years. And now, be the mayor of the city when it shuts down is really a kick in the stomach. I really hate it.
Yeah. So what are your feelings about this plant closing? Why is there no hope?
Well, we still are holding out hope that General Motors will put something in there in the future. But right now, General Motors is not committing to anything.
Yeah. Yeah, we understand that GM has offered the workers buyout packages, $140,000 for 10 years or more of service, $70,000 for less than 10 years. And that's got to soften the blow a little bit. But you're looking at a city of 7,000 people and losing 1,200 jobs in just about 2 months.
I can't think of a worse time to lose your livelihood than at Christmas. And, you know, $140,000 buyout, for lack of better words, is chump change. Yeah, it's a nice check, but they'll end up with anywhere from $85,000 to $90,000 after taxes, which is less than 2 years' pay. And if you don't know how to manage your money, you're going to be in trouble real quick.
And it's not like they could hop over, you know, to the other huge facility that's going to hire 1,200 people in town.
You don't have that anymore. Years ago, if you didn't like one job, you go to another. You grew up in this area. Not necessarily thinking about going to college. You grew up thinking, I'm going to grow up, get me a job in a factory, and make the big money. And that's no longer available. In the past couple of years, we've lost thousands of jobs, not just 1,200. There were about 4,500 people at that facility just a couple of years ago.
Oh, so it's been steadily going down.
Yes.
The plant made sports utility vehicles like the Chevy Trailblazer. Well, you know, the hope that you had was that GM could retool the plant and make something else like the Chevy Volt. This is the electric car that GM wants to have in showrooms by 2010. But, you know, critics of GM, and I'm reading blogs on the Dayton Daily News, I mean, people are, you know, very angry that GM didn't adjust to more fuel-efficient cars sooner. How do you feel about that?
Well, GM was building what people wanted, but it appears that the same mistake was made, you know, within a 30-year time span, back in the 70s when we had the gas shortage. Everybody wanted to go to the small cars, and it hurt GM pretty badly back then. So it's just looks like history's repeated itself as far as gasoline hurting GM.
Sure. Yeah. And so I guess the question is, I mean, is there some anger that GM didn't learn?
Well, let me say this. The IUECWA has been over backwards to accommodate GM. We've had competitive agreements. We're probably the first union that agreed to 55% wages, and it took 10 years to reach parity. So our union has always worked well with GM to make them competitive. Based on that, they could make a car approximately $5 an hour cheaper than Honda and Toyota. So I think the union has done their part in trying to do everything they can to work with General Motors. Why they chose not to accept that or put another product in that facility, I can't answer for.
Yeah. Well, so what do you do now? We understand that Logistics Services, which is a supplier to the plant, is also laying off 50 workers the same day, 2 days before Christmas, December 23rd. Obviously, this is going to have a trickle-down effect. People won't go out to eat as much. You know, other businesses in town are going to suffer. Your director of economic development, Michael Davis, has said, I don't know what we're going to do. What are you trying to do to plan for this?
It's going to be a tough task. You know, you're losing your largest employer, you're losing your largest tax base, and, you know, we'll have to sit down and take a look at our budget and live within our means like all American families.
Yeah. You know, we just wish you well with all of this.
Moraine is a tough city, and we'll survive. We just have to work through it. That's all you can do.
Leonard Johnson, mayor of Moraine, Ohio, where the GM plant, where he worked for 30 years before becoming mayor, is scheduled to close on December 23rd. Mayor, thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. A boy watches as a flock of geese fly across a bleak landscape. Cut to a man sitting, mute, in the dark. A dead body lies in a room nearby. A woman, fatigue in her face, leaves for her menial job. And that's just the beginning of the new independent film Ballast, which won a director's award at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year, and praise from the New York Times, Variety, for its understated portrayal of three damaged lives in the Mississippi Delta. Lance Hammer is writer, director, editor, producer, and distributor of Ballast. It is truly an independent film, and Lance joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Thank you. I really appreciate that you have me here.
Well, we appreciated the film, and I read you were inspired to make it while driving through the area. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was, you know, I was actually in Memphis, and I was thinking about writing a film in Tennessee, and it was the wintertime, and I was expecting the cotton fields and the verdant landscapes and the billowing clouds and, you know, the stereotypical image of the South and the heat. But in fact, it's the opposite. It's the moon. The fields are fallow. It's muddy and wet and gray skies. It's very cold and quiet. That quiet has this kind of sorrow to it that moved me. And at the same time, the intense beauty that of the place itself created something that was, you know, I was compelled to make a film that communicated this emotion I was feeling.
And into this film, you place several African-American characters who are also so quiet most of the time. What is your point about that? I mean, long stretches where no one says anything, people sit alone. Is that about poverty? Is that about the South? I mean, what were you saying there?
You know, this film is very site-specific. I wrote a film that dealt with universals. It was about grieving. It was about perseverance in the face of, you know, tremendous sorrow. And then I actually cast people from the place.
Right, and we should say, here you are, a white man, going to the Mississippi Delta saying, I want to make a film. And what was the initial reaction to that?
At first, there was caution. I mean, there's a great openness of spirit there and generosity, but also skepticism for outsiders, and particularly the film industry, because the film industry comes in there and makes films about the blues and civil rights and cliches.
Civil rights and the blues.
Civil rights and the blues. The civil rights within the blues. So it took a while to communicate that I was trying to make something different, and I was trying to make something that incorporated people from the townships to bring their own language to the film, to have their own voice, and co-author the film with me.
Here are some of the names. Michael J. Smith plays Lawrence, the lead character. Jemiren Ross plays James, the young 12-year-old at the time. Tara Riggs plays James' mom, Marley. And Johnny McPhail plays a neighbor. Let's just set up the film a little bit. Lawrence is the character who, in the beginning, is seemingly frozen in thought. Johnny comes to see if he's okay and finds out along with us that Lawrence's twin brother Darius is dead in the next room. Suddenly, as John the neighbor calls 911, Lawrence, who hasn't spoken a word, grabs a gun and attempts suicide.
Yes, I'll stay here until someone arrives. Yes, that's great. Okay. About how long will that be? Okay.
Lance Hammer, these are not veteran actors, maybe little, you know, classes here and there. But the reality in that moment and others is stunning.
Yeah, everybody in the film is a non-professional. They haven't had acting experience at all, except for Johnny McPhail, who has been in a couple of films. And that, I was very reluctant to do that, but he was the right guy for the job.
Yeah.
But it was very important that these people had never had experience with a script, didn't attempt to act, didn't know what acting was, because I was interested in their language, their voice, their emotion. Everything had to go through that real person.
So you didn't even tell them. They you did the scene by scene. They didn't even know what the next chapter
exactly
was going to be.
They never read the script. I didn't give them the script to see. We talked about everything verbally, and it was important that they didn't know what was going to happen next, because that's the way life is.
So they could react to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Did anything that the actors were doing as they worked through the scripts cause you to change your idea of how the story should go?
Absolutely. That was a significant part of the process. We'd start with what I'd written, you know, I'd describe that verbally, and then we'd try it as a starting place. And if it wasn't working, I'd usually identify that that's not working, and I think it's because you don't believe it. So tell me, what would you do instead? And so we try that, and sometimes we end up in a totally different place from where we started. I'd say 30% of what you see in the film is completely off the page, you know. And all of the language is from the actors.
Well, Lawrence survives his suicide. We discover that he is young James' uncle, that Darius, the man who was dead in the next room, is James's now late father. They were all estranged, though. And young James yearns for a normal life. In this scene, we just hear this quiet request. He asks his mom if he can sign up for the youth basketball league.
That guy could play this year? Obviously, why not? Sound like a good idea to me. It costs $200. Well, maybe we can figure something out.
I mean, that speaks to the poverty. $20, she doesn't know if she can swing it. Well, James has also been playing with a gun in some stomach-turning scenes. He gets mixed up with crack cocaine dealers. Most of the film is about lives of quiet desperation, but then there's a couple scenes. Here's one of, you know, very loud, noisy desperation. James is driving with his mom, and they're forced off the road and beaten by the drug dealers.
Come on, look out! Look out! Come on, get out! Come on, get out!
Lance Hammer, this is, it's hard to hear it again. You're always nervous watching this movie. Even in the quiet, contemplative scenes, you're just nervous because they live in a place where there's landmines.
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in exploring the issue of brutality and the brutality that comes with desperation. There's a great legacy of violence in the Delta, and I wanted to speak of that in very oblique ways, but not about, you know, specifically the violence that has been perpetuated, you know, by whites against blacks. A different kind, the kind that still exists there today, related to the lack of money.
We should say you've been an art director in other films, and the look is just so... I tried to find one thing of bright color, a picture on a wall, a flower in a field, an article of clothing. There is nothing in this landscape.
Right. That's that place in the winter, and it's a grayscale landscape. But, you know, the art direction really was, as an art director, I'm so used to creating artificial environments to mimic reality. And a lot of art directors feel like, why are we doing this? Why not just go find the thing and shoot it as it lies, you know? So this was my goal, was to make a film where we found locations and we couldn't touch them. They had to exist intact, and that's the way we photographed them, because they're perfect. They're from reality.
Are you going to be able to keep this style? I mean, here you are, this big independent film festival hit. You turned down a distribution deal to distribute this yourself, but I'm just wondering if the next one will be harder to turn down. If someone comes along and says, ah, we're going to give you several million, we just would like a few more, oh, trailing camera shots, or, you know, of some more of the commercial film feel. Will you be able to resist that?
Yes, I have no interest in doing that. There's a necessity in the soul somewhere to make something that's very uncompromised, and I'm not interested in compromising creatively. It's not part of what I want to leave behind.
Lance Hammer is the writer, producer, director, editor, and distributor of the new film Ballast. By the way, ballast, you know, what did you mean by ballast?
It's a word that popped into my head when I was writing one day, and it's both a something that gives you stability, but it's also a burden, you know, it's a weight. And when in a time of chaos, you need grounding, but you don't want to be weighed down. So you're constantly trying to figure out when something is a burden or when it's something you need for emotional security. And all these characters are seeking that in their lives so desperately, a sense of security or grounding. They find it in each other, but they find it in people that used to be a tremendous weight to them.
Well, for more information about Ballast, go to our website, here-now.org. Lance Hammer, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.